Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. I'm thrilled to be able to bring you episode 154, featuring an interview with author Angel Millar about his excellent new book, The Crescent and the Compass, Islam, Freemasonry, Esotericism, and Revolution in the Modern Age, published by Newman Books. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. This episode is also made possible by an additional donation from Steve in the UK. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Thelesis Aura, an occult media production, education, and resource company. Publishers of Lon Milo Duquette's Tarot of Ceremonial Magic. Distributors of Kat Luneau's Sacred Imagery. And host to online training and instruction by some of the world's leading teachers of the esoteric arts. For more, visit ThelesisAura.com. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center, located in historic Salem, Massachusetts, offers unique instruction in the arcane arts from some of the most experienced and talented teachers around. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center is committed to the authentic Western esoteric tradition by providing students with quality, in-depth classes along with all the books and ritual tools one could ever want, many of them handcrafted. The ancient mysteries have a new home in the Witch City. Stop by the shop or visit online at hermeticarts.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Metabolic Alchemy, alchemical elixirs for health and personal development. Metabolic Alchemy offers alchemical elixirs based on the five elements of Western alchemy. Focus on one element or take the complete journey through the elements program to refine all the elements of your nature. Metabolic Alchemy also produces wellness elixirs for sinus, sleep, energy, and relaxation. Visit metabolic-alchemy.com. Now, in episode number 154, an interview with Angel Millar. In his third book, The Crescent and the Compass, Angel has brilliantly exposed a neglected topic. The history and connections he elucidates in the book are not only crucial for an accurate understanding of Islam and Freemasonry today, but also the darker side of the story, anti-Masonry, conspiracies, and violent reactionaries. It is extremely interesting and filled with new insights, and we should all take notice. It would be difficult to overstate the importance of this work. I don't know that I've ever found a book on esotericism and history that was as informative and timely as this one. It provides an entirely new depth of understanding and analysis. Now, in Angel's first book, Freemasonry History, he explored the history of the fraternity in Europe and America, especially in relation to the development of its initiation rituals, symbolism, and material culture. His second book, Freemasonry: Foundation of the Western Esoteric Tradition, is an exploration of the influence of Freemasonry on modern Western occultism. Angel is also the editor and main writer for People of Shambhala at peopleofshambhala.com, a webzine dedicated to understanding the body and spirit in modernity. He was our guest previously in podcast episode number 50 and more recently in podcast episode 151. Check the show notes for links to those podcast episodes. You can find more information about the Crescent and the Compass at Islam-Freemasonry.com. I strongly recommend this book to anyone interested in Freemasonry, history, international affairs, and current events. I think the interview demonstrates why. So without further ado, Angel Miller, thank you so much for joining us again on a Cult of Personality podcast. It's always wonderful to speak with you.
Well, thanks very much, Greg. It's good to be speaking with you again as well.
Today we're going to be talking about your recent book, The Crescent and the Compass: Islam, Esotericism, Freemasonry, and Revolution in the Modern Age, published by Newman Books. I'd like to begin with a broad overview of where you're coming from in writing the book and the larger forces that you see at work and that you're analyzing in detail with the book.
Sure, sure. Well, as I mentioned last time, but it's worth repeating, I think, that originally I was interested in focusing on the mythology that is put forth in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a anti-Semitic forgery that was produced by the Russian secret police at the end of the 19th century. And essentially, the premise of the book is that the Zionists are trying to take control of the world. And there's one chapter in particular that claims that Freemasons are sort of the unwitting slaves of Zionists, and they are helping to bring this plan about. And I was interested in this mythology and particularly how it has influenced and been used by the extreme right, the extreme left, mostly under Stalin, and in Islamism today. As I mentioned last time, I define Islamism as being specific to having this mythology incorporated, and it is referenced in various texts. So it's not just a supposition that it's been an influence. It really has been an influence. But the more I researched, although I already knew about some connections between Islam and Freemasonry in the modern era, such as René Guénon, who was originally, he grew up Catholic, was involved in theosophy, was involved in sort of esoteric Freemasonry in France, and later converted or quote-unquote moved into Islam and moved to Cairo and spent the remainder of his life living in Egypt as a Muslim, essentially, and he was the founder of the traditionalist school of thought, which we can go into. And I was aware of that connection, obviously the Shriners and various connections such as that. But then I started to find out, discover more and more connections. For example, Henry William Quilliam, better known as Sheikh Abdullah Quilliam, who was one of the early British converts to Islam and the founder, at least of the first official mosque in Britain during the Victorian era. He was heavily involved in not just Freemasonry, but also esoteric Freemasonry as well. And when I began to find these connections, it struck me that the convergence of Islam and Freemasonry, or at least ideas about Islam and esoteric Freemasonry, had had quite a big impact on the various forms of spirituality and thinkers gain on is actually more influential than we might think. And also in black nationalism in America, you have a movement such as Moorish science, which is a kind of religion, and Freemasonry and Islam and Rosicrucianism and sort of a proto New Age thought are of all influences there.
Widely diverse groups that have been influenced by these ideas.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems to be within a period of about 75 to 100 years that you find these connections all across the world. And I was interested in why this would be.
When you did your research and were writing the book, I'm curious if you felt any desire to sort of stratify what you were finding into sort of Freemasonry as positive and then on the other side, Freemasonry as negative, because it seems like there's a real divide between the way people perceived it who were connected with Islam in one form or another.
Yeah, well, exactly, right? So today, you do have groups such as, or movements such as Al-Qaeda, which will occasionally make these sort of anti-Masonic statements, also Hamas, some other groups. And it seems that this sort of anti-Masonic rhetoric is really a part of their ideology, and we can go into more about why that would be. But if you go back to, say, 1850, 1860, maybe a little after that, then Freemasonry is seen to be much more positive. And there were various revolutionaries of that time who were either Muslim or nominally Muslim who joined Masonic lodges and tried to either to sort of use Masonic lodges to promote their own sort of anti-colonialist agenda, or in some cases really did to feel that, well, this was a kind of a movement that could transcend national and ethnic and religious barriers, and that it was a positive influence in that sense. So in a way, it's, you could think of it almost like communism, where people are joining because they don't want to be nationalistic, or they don't want to have this sort of ethno-nationalism in the country where they live. And, you know, obviously in the case of Jews in Europe and Russia, there was a lot of discrimination and occasionally periods of violence. And so there was a sort of impetus to be involved in movements that try to transcend that, and communism is one. But Freemasonry is another, and unlike communism, Freemasonry, of course, places God at the heart of this sort of brotherly experience. So it's not something that a Muslim can't join. You could, in a certain way, sort of believe that, well, this is fine for a believing Muslim. Of course, many Muslims would say that's not okay, but revolutionaries in the 19th century, some of them, at least for a short period, believed that there was some potential with Freemasonry to overcome these boundaries and borders between people. And of course, you have to take in consideration that this is a time of colonialism, so there's a real a benefit to not having these barriers, because Muslims, by and large, in the Middle East are getting the short end of the stick. So they've been underpaid in government positions and this kind of thing. And you have foreign colonial workers being much higher paid and this kind of thing. So,
yeah, it seems like it would be much more appealing in that type of environment than maybe it would in today's Middle East.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Definitely.
So I'd like to ask you about why it is, or maybe what characteristics are present in Masonry that Muslims might find similar to their own tradition, or sort of resonate with their own experience of the more esoteric side of their religion.
Yeah, well, obviously, many Muslims, just as many Christians would say that, no, this is something you can't join. And if you go online and you do a Google search for Freemasonry Islam, then most of the sites that would come up would be, you get a few Christian sites saying that they're both terrible, but you also get a lot of Muslim sites saying, no, you can't join. Freemasonry if you're a Muslim, and this is against what we stand for and this kind of thing. But so I don't want to say that Muslims would find things in it. I mean, some Muslims might, many do not. But of that period, as I say, it was a way of really transcending all kinds of social inequalities. So it seemed to offer that very positive aspect, and you could still believe in God. The other aspect was some of the Muslim revolutionaries, such as Sayyid Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani. And maybe some others also perceived that Freemasonry was one of the factors in the French Revolution, and therefore if you could take this sort of revolutionary brotherhood and you could use it for your own ends. And I don't necessarily agree that Freemasonry was such a big factor in the French Revolution at all, but that was a perception.
So they saw it as really a means for subversive political action.
Yeah, and in a way it's slightly contradictory, because obviously the French Revolution was very much against religion and the idea of God, but certainly against religion anyway. And But for Muslim revolutionaries in the Middle East, it was perceived more that, well, you had that religious element, or at least an element that wasn't going to conflict with religion. But you had a very much a revolutionary idea. And, of course, in a certain sense, it is revolutionary, because if you join, say, a British or a French lodge or an Italian lodge in Egypt, and they were there, certainly, and you were with Europeans who in some respects, or many respects, were sort of lording it over you, and better paid, and they were, the Western countries were more or less exploiting Middle Eastern states, such as Egypt at that time. And yet, you could join a Masonic lodge as a Muslim, in some cases, and then you were said to be on the level, you were completely equal to the Europeans that were in that lodge. But outside the lodge, you had a much lower status. So in a certain sense, it was revolutionary. It wasn't necessarily intended to be, but in that kind of environment, if you join a society and now you're equal, then that is a kind of revolutionary step. So,
yeah. Boy, it's fascinating, and I hope I'm not really overemphasizing this point, but I find it really fascinating the way that Freemasonry seems to be very much a mirror for the person who's looking at it. The revolutionary sees a society that they can join and maybe get a leg up and maybe use for their own political ideas and see it in as a way of pulling strings behind society. But then you have maybe others who view it as in a very similar manner, but pulling strings that they don't really like being pulled, in a sense. But overall, the emphasis I feel is like a very much on a sort of conspiratorial portrayal of Freemasonry by this, I guess, sort of nuanced and diverse range of people. And I think that is not uncommon, even, all over the world. I've encountered it myself in everyday life, from conversations in the street all the way to conversations in the university classroom, where people have this very conspiratorial and ultimately negative image of Freemasonry.
Yeah, that's often the case. But I think we should also say that it's not limited to non-Masons, right? I
mean, that's right.
If you talk to 10 Freemasons, I would think probably half of them have ideas about the society that are wrong, if not crazy. So, and they often tie it back to the Knights Templar or ancient Egypt or whatever kind of mythology, in a way, flatters them, because there have been so many of these theories from the Druids and the Vikings right through to the Royal Society claiming to have founded it and all this kind of stuff. So Historical inaccuracy is definitely not limited to non-Masons when it comes to the subject of Freemasonry. And let's be honest, you know, many of these sort of fantastical theories and books written by Freemasons have been adopted by anti-Masons who say, oh, whoa, you know, look at this, you know, so it's of unhelpful, really.
Yeah, your point is very well taken. That there's very valid reasons that this situation is the way it is. I'd like to talk a little bit about how Islam has a more holistic approach, I guess you could say, to the esoteric and exoteric sides of the religion. Maybe not everyone sees it quite that way, but in your book, you really do a great job of summarizing the way that the esoteric really comes through the exoteric. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about that.
Sure. So obviously, today when we turn on the TV or, you know, look at the news on the internet or anything, Islam by and large is tied to very negative events in the world, such as terrorism in Iraq with ISIS or ISIL. Or IS, or however it's whatever variation is being used. So I think we have a very polarized view of what Islam is. And then part of the problem is the political commentary that we hear as well. So we'll get back to that maybe. But Islam, like Christianity, which is another religion that tends to be stereotyped a lot, is a very big thing and has a very diverse range of ways of looking at it. And with Christianity, of course, although I see a lot of bashing of Christianity on Facebook, for example, I mean, it goes right from sort of very mystical Russian Orthodox Christianity and, you know, obscure sort of Martinism, right through to sort of evangelical Christianity and all kinds of political versions of Christianity, which don't seem to have a lot to do with the New Testament or what Christians are supposed to believe. And the same with Islam as well. So there is this other side, which is a very mystical. Obviously, Sufism is the sort of esoteric form of Islam that most people know about. But also with Shiism or esoteric Shiism as well. This has a very, very strong esoteric aspect. So in Shiism, there are 12 Shiism, there are 12 Imams. And the idea is that, of course, you have the Quran, and but you need the Imams who essentially sort of interpret the Quran for each period. So they bring forth the esoteric understanding of the Quran. And so you always need either a prophet or an imam. And I should say that in Sunni Islam, the word imam just really means priest. But in Shiism, imam is a much bigger thing. It's almost like a prophet. There are in 12 Shiism, which is the mainstream Shiism, there are only 12 imams throughout history.
Mm. And did the Sufi movement and the Ismailis proceed from the Shia?
Sufism seems to have been influenced by Shiism. At least that's my reading of it anyway. Mm-hmm. And when Shiism was replaced by Sunnism in various parts of the world because of political and other upheavals, Sufism emerged as a more of a codified system or set of systems, whereas before the Sufis were sort of Islamic mystics, but they were more sort of individuals, sort of like more like Hindu holy men in a way, that sort of like fakirs who didn't really have a following or a code particularly, but with Shiism you start to get, after Shiism you start to get these more codified Sufism, and it seems to be influenced by Shia Islam to a certain extent. So both, for example, place a lot of emphasis on the figure of not just Muhammad, but Ali as well, so that Muhammad brings the exoteric understanding of Islam. It's not to say that he doesn't know the esoteric, of course he does, but then according to Shiism and Sufism, Ali brings the esoteric understanding of Islam.
Okay, thank you. I'm wondering if you might want to talk a little bit about some of the figures that you focus on in the book, maybe beginning with Sayyid Jamal al-Din al-Afghani.
Okay, in regards to esotericism or just in general?
Maybe you could just start with sort of like who he is a little bit more, and then
okay.
we sort of delve into his esoteric leanings.
Okay. Well, it might be better actually to start with Ayatollah Khomeini.
All right. Maybe that'd be better lead-in since people already know who he is.
Yeah, exactly. And although certainly a much more controversial figure, we can work back to al-Afghani from there. So, of course, in the West today, we know Ayatollah Khomeini, who was really the person behind the Islamic Revolution in Iran of the late 1970s. And of course, in the West today, we have a very specific understanding of Khomeini. He's mostly spoken about in relation to the fatwa that he issued against the author Salman Rushdie. Salman Rushdie, as most people know, wrote the satanic verses, which would seem to be very blasphemous in the eyes of Islam. And Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa calling for his death. And of course, you have the American embassy hostage crisis in the late after the Islamic Revolution as well. So in the West, he's very much seen to be this sort of dour, a stern sort of enemy of the West. And although there are political aspects in my book, you know, I didn't want to make it about politics, quite honestly. I'm more interested in connections of between the East and West in regards to spirituality, and also the influence of Islamic spirituality in general. So whether it's on Prince Charles or Ayatollah Khomeini. And Khomeini is actually a much more three-dimensional figure than we generally realize in the West. And from a really a young age, or at least as a young man, he had a very strong influence, a strong interest in Islamic Gnosticism or Irfan. And he studied this at seminaries and actually taught Islamic Gnosticism to a few select students during his early career, we could say. And Islamic Gnosticism, even at that time, was seemed to be quite a taboo subject in these more conservative seminaries. So it was actually a slightly dangerous subject that was sort of a little bit radical even then. And it was also disliked by the secular elite as well. And both of them sort of perceived it to be sort of the realm of radicalism and not adhering to the rules, which, you know, conservative clerics and the secular government were more interested in having people that, you know, behaved themselves and did not go off on these sort of wild tangents as it was perceived. So he actually faced quite a lot of obstacles and even some discrimination because of this interest. And what's sort of remarkable about Khomeini is not just that he wrote books on Islamic Gnosticism early on and actually wrote mystical poetry as well, but after the revolution, he actually went on TV. He was actually asked to give a series of lectures, and he agreed to do that. And he actually talked about Islamic Gnosticism in some of those lectures, and tried to tell people that Islamic Gnosticism or mysticism and Islamic philosophy, which is only a slightly less taboo subject at times, were not radical, but that they said the same things as the theologians, and that people shouldn't be worried, that it was just a different sense of language, and that they all worked harmoniously together. And it has actually been suggested that the Islamic Republic, or Khomeini's idea of the Islamic Republic, is the kind of exoteric manifestation of sort of esoteric ideas about Islam. So it's a sort of union with God in a kind of mystical sense, lived out in daily life. And it's not to say that that it's all good. You know, there are many things we could complain about, obviously, but that it has been suggested that that is the idea. And incidentally, by the way, Khomeini's concept of the Islamic Republic as well was actually, it's not just Islamic, although obviously it's mostly that, but he was also influenced by Plato and Plato's Republic in particular. So
now it's interesting because rather than seeing it as, you know, as an outsider, you know, I don't see it as the union of the esoteric and the exoteric. What I perceive more would, or the question I would ask rather, is knowing that about Khomeini, would it be likely that he was really a figurehead for this revolution and this holding that office? And, you know, there were others obviously pulling the strings from behind the scenes, or maybe maybe not even so behind the scenes, really.
Yeah, no, I really think it was Khomeini's force as an individual that was completely the engine for the Islamic Revolution, really, to be honest. And I mean, he was really able to inspire people. We may not like what he did, we may not like the Islamic Republic, but I think you still have to acknowledge that by his sort of force and his will, he really was able to inspire people to make serious changes, and was able to basically sort of switch the lights on and off in Tehran as he wanted. And the Shah of Iran had absolutely no power to stop this. So, yeah. No, I don't want to be seen to be either criticizing or defending the Islamic Republic or anything that may have happened in the Islamic Republic,
yeah, certainly,
to be honest with you. And
you know, I don't mean to put you in that position either.
No, that's fine. And, you know, again, one of the reasons why I don't want to be involved in what I'm saying, whether it's good or bad, is that I don't think that that is really a contribution in this book. You know, I think that this book, The Crescent and the Compass, is unique in that it does explore the influence of Islamic spirituality and these very significant connections between the East and West since about 1850 in regards to spirituality. And so I don't want to go down this road of saying this is really bad or this is really good, because I think it would just take away from that. And you can read so many books about, or articles about, whether it's good or bad. So that's already been done. Yeah. But my focus is, what did Khomeini want it to be, or what did he think it was going to be? And obviously, I think that Khomeini really, there's no denying that he had a very profound understanding of esotericism and the how the exoteric and esoteric work together. I mean, his lectures are really very, they're very sound. And I read a lot of writing on esotericism and the esoteric and the exoteric that are not at all sound. But with any kind of strong ideology, when you try to manifest this, in the world for a society, things can go very badly wrong, right?
So, yeah, I think we've seen that many times when you mix spirituality or religion and politics. The history of Western Europe bears that out pretty well.
Yeah, and obviously something like a communism, which it maybe in theory is a great idea, right? We'll all be equal, and because we'll all be equal, we'll all be able to be creative. No one's going to be oppressed and everything. But whenever it's been tried, I mean, it seems to be a lot of bloodshed is spilled, and the end results don't seem to look an awful lot like equality because the human nature intervenes, right? That's the problem.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, we have our ideal philosophy, and then we have reality, and the two are separated by a gulf so wide that it's really difficult to bridge it philosophically. And I think that's why I asked the question. But I do applaud your stance looking at this information without any kind of judgment or prejudice or anything, because it does give us a much clearer picture. And you know, obviously I have to ask that, but book is definitely better because of the stance you took, I think.
Yeah, and I'm really just interested in these largely unknown connections and these largely unknown aspects, which is why I focused on Khomeini's interest in Islamic Gnosticism and his teaching of Islamic Gnosticism and his attitude towards it, which we don't know in the West. I don't want to write a book about Khomeini and the Salman Rushdie fatwa. Everybody knows that. So that's not interesting to me. But I think as well, I mean, I would say this, that in the West, we're very sort of suspicious of heroes, and you know, Islam has heroes, whether it's, you know, the Prophet Muhammad or Ali or both. But one of the, I think maybe the strange side effects of that is that we don't really respect our enemies, or we don't respect our opponents or people that are opposed to us. And maybe I'm romanticizing the past, but I mean, certainly today, politics is so vitriolic and just unpleasant, and there's no respecting the other side from either side. And you know, if you're going to spend several years writing about people, and I started writing this book about 6 years ago, I think that you have to find what's interesting about the people you're writing about, and you have to respect them. You don't have to like everything about them, and you can oppose certain things that they've done. But I think you have to see what's also interesting and profound about them as well.
Certainly.
I'm not endorsing anyone that I write about, but I want to find what's interesting about anyone I write about.
And you've certainly done that without a doubt.
Good.
One of the really interesting figures that you focused on is René Guénon.
Right.
As many people know, he moved into Islam.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about him and his interest in Islam and maybe why he arrived there.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, he was a French metaphysician, if you like. He grew up in Catholic. He was involved in theosophy for a while, although he turned very much against it. He was involved in esoteric Freemasonry, and even after being initiated into Freemasonry and really quite actively involved in it, he's a very odd and controversial character in many respects, but he then started writing for a Catholic anti-Masonic periodical as well. And later on, he lost hope in all of these movements, particularly theosophy. He did actually retain some hope in Freemasonry, actually, even to the day he died, and thought that if there was going to be a spiritual revival, it would come through Freemasonry. But he did not like what he saw on the ground. He did not like Freemasonry as it was being practiced. And this may come as a surprise or a shock to some listeners, but Guénon essentially believed that the Catholic Church, certainly theosophy, and Freemasonry were all too liberal and too modern. And he ultimately, quote-unquote, moved into Islam. He became a Sufi. And we say moved into rather than converted, because he was the founder of the traditionalist school of thought, which, you know, believes in esoteric and exoteric knowledge, which obviously work together to get complete understanding. And obviously within that there are sort of levels of understanding or spiritual understanding, which of course you find in Sufism as well, sort of hierarchy of understanding and gnosis. But traditionalism believes that the major world religions, particularly, I guess, the monotheistic ones, so that's a sort of extended now to other religions such as Hinduism, that they are in a way reflections of a primordial religion which came straight from God. So they're kind, in a way, they're kind of approximations, and you have to join one of these religions and practice within it, and essentially be a faithful practitioner of one of them. But through your esoteric understanding and your commitment to that religion, that you will come to perceive the essential religion as revealed by God, essentially. So that's why you would say moved into rather than converted to Islam. Hmm. But Gainon's traditionalism has had a big effect on Islamic scholarship. Several prominent scholars of Islam, particularly in the West, were traditionalist, and also on in politics, and even on the thought of the current heir to the British throne, Charles, Prince of Wales. So, although he's a very minor figure in some respects, his influence is disproportionately large in certain areas.
Yeah, I feel like he, because of his writings and he's, like as you mentioned, so influential. I think he's really been a conduit for Islam and certainly Sufism into the West more than it was already.
Yeah, well, traditionalism, although of course you could belong to any of the major religions, and maybe there would even be traditionalists who would extend that to sort of more minor, more modern faith, I'm not sure. But because he did move into Islam and Sufism and move to Egypt, and I believe he adhered to the Sharia as well. So there is a strong sympathy for Islam within traditionalism, and this is also the case in sort of more traditionalist political groups, which are often perceived to be and may perceive themselves to be more on the sort of far right spectrum of politics, particularly in Europe. Although that's maybe not always the case.
Another figure you mentioned earlier, and I'd like to just circle back to, is Noble Drew Ali, the founder and prophet of Moorish science, because I feel like this is an often underappreciated movement.
Yeah, it definitely is. And this was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, in a way, black nationalist movement, although Irish people were able to join it as well. There was some sympathy for Irish people in America because they also were perceived as the underdog. But Noble Drew Ali, who was probably born Timothy Drew, he, in the early 20th century, created a new kind of faith called Moorish science, which drew from, certainly from Freemasonry and the Shriners, some aspects of Rosicrucianism and New Thought, which is kind of positive thinking movement back then, and also from the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus as well, and some trappings and some aspects from Islam as well. So the Holy Book of the Moorish Science is the Circle 7 Quran, although it doesn't have a lot in common with the actual Quran, but there's a kind of fusion of Freemasonry and some other aspects, some other religions, Islam being one of them. And it certainly had an influence. I mean, it was really the only sort of mass movement like this at the time, I think, that was somewhat black nationalist at least, and a new kind of faith that was aimed at empowering non-white people in particular. And it had some influence on the early Nation of Islam as well. So its influence is not insignificant.
Yeah. I think it has some real significance.
It's actually still around today, but in a very much smaller number of adherents, I believe.
Yeah. Kind of one of those interesting roads, interesting paths in the esoteric realm that many people don't hear about.
Just in the African American community, Freemasonry and the Shriners maybe had more significance at that time and before that than they did even among European Americans. And we always hear about how influential Freemasonry allegedly was, with George Washington being a Freemason, and that's to some degree completely true. But in among the sort of African American or Black community, it served some very specific and important functions, I think. And beginning with Prince Hall, free Black Freemasonry really sort of perceived itself to be as sort of legitimate as a white Freemasonry, if not more legitimate, sort of morally speaking. Mm-hmm. And so I think in a way it was a kind of Black nationalist movement within the Black community, these sort of African American or Black lodges that they could say that, well, okay, we're not recognized by these white lodges or by mainstream America, but we are ethically and morally more legitimate than those lodges because we are living the Masonic values and they are not, because they claim to want a united brotherhood of man, but we're the only ones that are doing it, right?
Right.
So I think that psychologically, that's quite a big boost. But also then, Prince Hall himself said that, even the white Freemasons look up to or not exactly worship, but place a large emphasis on Solomon, which he referred to as a black man. So in a certain sense, or even there, although there's a sort of aspect of this sort of universal brotherhood, it's still a sense of maybe a slightly black nationalistic, ethno-nationalistic aspect as well. So it's really elevating black people morally and even sort of racially in a way, in confrontation with the majority white society, where they're not really being fairly treated. And even into the 20th, well, we know there's even discrimination today, but there were very harsh conditions even in the North, which is sometimes seen to be more of a bastion of sort of equality and liberalism. And black people also faced sort of rabid discrimination. They could only be hired in the most menial positions, and essentially you were forced into poor ghettos where, with unsanitary conditions and this kind of thing. So there was a lot to fight against, even in the north of the U.S.
Certainly, yeah. And it certainly makes sense why Moorish science as a real self-improvement, self-reliant type of philosophy makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and even, the Nation of Islam is much more controversial, but, there is a thread that runs through, right?
Certainly,
From Freemasonry, and I'm not saying that the Nation of Islam is in any way Masonic, but if you look at this sort of trajectory of black nationalism in the U.S., it's definitely about elevating black people and showing that they are at least ethically and morally as legitimate, if not more so, right?
In their
behavior, so
certainly, yeah.
Yeah, so these movements are important.
Yeah, and it was interesting to be able to read about them in this context.
Yeah.
Now I want to switch focus a little bit. You mentioned the protocols of the Elders of Zion as sort of the genesis for where you started your research and focus on, for the book.
Right.
And I guess before we get into more of the nitty gritty about the protocols and their effect, I'm curious about the larger themes, because you have this document, which, you know, from the Russian secret police prior to the revolution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it focuses on Jews and sort of this internationalist conspiracy.
Yeah.
And in your book, you actually talk about how in many ways, and you really show it through your research, how Freemasonry can be seen as the movement which fosters the idea of globalism.
Right, right.
So it's very interesting to me because you have Freemasonry cast in this sort of villainous aspect along with internationalism, globalism, Jews, and bankers. And the fact is there's and I don't certainly see it the way that the protocols describe or the conspiracy theorists advocate, but there is a grain, a very small grain of truth in that, even though they've extrapolated wildly into very bizarre conclusions. And I think I can only guess that that's why these ideas seem to keep perpetuating.
Well, I think they perpetuate for a couple of reasons. We'll come back to that. But just to say that, yes, one of the reasons is it contains a grain of truth. But all conspiracy theories contain some truth. It's just the context that the conspiracy theorist doesn't understand, right? So if you listen to sort of the Illuminati, anti-Masonic kind of conspiracy theorists you find on like Christian, some fringy Christian podcasts and radio and stuff, this sort of thing, or not even Christian necessarily, but you know, there are some secular ones as well in the US. And, you know, they do have a lot of facts about Freemasonry and stuff like that. And they also have a lot of things that are wrong. And but more importantly, perhaps, is that they don't really understand the context. So that they, some little symbol, maybe they see a triangle somewhere and they go, whoa, crazy. You know, this is from some, this means that there's some 3,000-year-old conspiracy theory or conspiracy to oppress us by sort of lizard people or whatever. So it's the kind of context that's wrong, right? There are definitely facts there, but it's the interpretation and the understanding of how they fit in larger history that is usually wrong,
right?
Always wrong. Yeah. So that's the problem. But I think with the other aspect that makes conspiracy theories potent is that it explains the world to you, and you know, there is a kind of element of this thinking even in, say, occultism or religion in general, at its worst. But so the conspiracy theory, if you believe in a conspiracy theory, everything you see will corroborate that, right? So because even if you see some world event that completely contradicts everything you believe, you just say, aha, that means the people that are running the world know that we're onto them and they did that to throw us off, right? So everything you see supports your theory. It's, you cannot disprove it.
Yeah.
And because it does explain the world and also flatters your vanity at the same time, it's a very powerful thing. And it's not to say that some aspects of it are not wrong. Maybe some small aspects of it are right or in another context, perhaps. And I think with the protocols of the Elders of Zion, for example, I think the power of that text is the fact that it basically it takes human nature and then ascribes it to people you don't like, right? Mm-hmm. So it says, Zionists are controlling the press or whatever. Well, it's human nature, right, to not run. When you run a story in your newspaper, you don't exactly tell the truth, right? You give it a slant that that suits your way of thinking, because that's how you think, right?
Yeah.
So if you read the New York Times and then you watch, you know, Fox News or whatever, they can take the same set of facts and come up with completely different conclusions, right?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, and as well, but you know, both of them and all media outlets will leave out facts that are extremely significant.
Certainly.
But would not make the story, you know, it wouldn't have that wow factor without it. Mm. Like if they were balanced about it and said, well, this is this side and this is the other side, so you know, this is how it plays out. That would not be a major story, and it would bore most people, right? So you just go with one side, and then you have this much more sensational story, which sells newspapers, and of course, you know, flatters the political side that you're trying to appeal to anyway. So, but that's human nature. It's not that Zionists are controlling the world. Of course, there are, you know, there are, for example, pro-Israeli newspapers in Israel and in the U.S. and whatnot, and you know, so I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but you also have the opposite as well. So it's a much bigger mess than conspiracy theorists acknowledge.
Yeah, right?
That's the difference.
No, I just want to just briefly touch on this. It seems to me for people who may not be aware, it might be useful to mention the connection between Jews and Freemasons as seen in the protocols of the Elders of Zion is interesting. As far as I can tell, the connection is really the fact that Zionists want to reclaim, if you will, or claim this territory of Palestine or Israel, however you take it. And the Freemasons' mythology involves rebuilding the Temple of Solomon, which we believe to be in that place. So
yeah,
it's easy to sort of wrap these groups up together, because
yeah,
one's involved in it mythologically and the other, the Zionists, are involved in it in a very real world way.
Right. And just to say that there really have been Zionists, obviously, and, you know, the Zionist militias in Israel or in Palestine before Israel was founded. But I don't think that's quite what's in the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I think that's actually more of a later contribution to this conspiracy theory.
Okay.
But in the protocols of the Elders of Zion is really the idea that this secret group of Zionists, and probably not all Zionists, but this secret group of Zionists are taking over the world, and they are systematically knocking down monarchies and instituting democracy so that they can run the show, and that this is bad according to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, because the monarchies and the aristocracy, although oppressing people, are actually much more moderate and in support of their people than democracies, which, you know, do not necessarily look after the people. And, you know, you have sometimes exploitation by very large capitalistic corporations and this kind of thing. And of course, you know, there is an element of truth, right, to this sort of exploitation of like low wages and this kind of thing. But that's essentially the theory.
Yeah.
And Freemasons in this theory are the ones who are like secretly helping them. They're kind of like a sabotage group. But so that's how the protocols of the Elders of Zion portrays it.
And it seems to me that and you found this fascinating quote here, and this is how I believe many conspiracy theorists sort of perceive this idea, where Goebbels said, "I believe that the protocols are a forgery, but I believe in the intrinsic, but not the factual truth of them."
Right, so it becomes a kind of religious text, essentially. The some people will acknowledge that it's not factual, but they will say, but it essentially then becomes a kind of mythology, like a biblical mythology, where you can live your life through this text and see the world through it. And Julius Evola, who is a traditionalist but of a much more radical sort, who was close to the Mussolini government and also lectured to the SS, although they did not actually approve of him after that, but he And he communicated with Gainon for a couple of decades, although Gainon was very against traditionalists being involved in politics. But Evola also saw the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as a kind of a text through which you could understand the world. But although he also acknowledged that it wasn't factual, that it was a kind of mythology for him. But being a kind of esotericist, and I think this is a mistake, but he would say that, well, you can look at it esoterically and interpret the world through it. And it doesn't matter about facts, because he's interested in myth, right? So he might be interested in Norse mythology, which he would also say is not factual. So then he could apply the same understanding to the Protocols.
Right.
I mean, I would say that personally, I don't think that is real esotericism, actually. And in a certain sense, you do kind of have to perceive that the text you are looking at the world through, you do have to think that it is real, not that some guy made it up at the end of the 19th century, I think.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. Mm-hmm. And I just want to follow up and to ask you about this Protocols of the Elders of Zion then became highly influential throughout the Middle East through Arab groups.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And before that, it became very influential in Europe and some degree in America. There was an American edition, and it was translated into numerous European languages as well. And you mentioned Goebbels, so it was a big part of the propaganda of the Nazis. But it was also taken to the Middle East by Arab Christians, actually, and translated into Arabic. And later on became part of the mythology of Islamism, which again, people may use that term differently, but for me, Islamism is Muslim political thinkers or groups see the world through the Protocols or the Elders of Zion, essentially. That for me is what Islamism is. But even today, you do sometimes find much more radical and extreme groups quoting the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, or attacking Freemasonry and this kind of thing. But usually, yeah, Freemasonry, they're not really talking about the fraternity. It's the way that people use the Illuminati to mean government control or something.
Right, right.
Yeah. And for the Islamists, from what I have seen, and I've seen quite a lot, the word Freemasonry is usually used to mean something specific, and that is it means Western, usually American power, but not in the sense that they would use crusader. So, we often hear the term like Zionists and crusaders.
Yeah.
And the crusaders in that part are Western and American powers that are using military force to invade countries, whereas the term Freemasonry means, usually means like cultural subversion behind the scenes, so alcohol, pornography, this kind of thing.
Right.
And those are real examples that I've seen given, so that's what it means.
Thank you for clarifying that, yeah. There's probably too many to mention in just a few minutes, but what are some of the major takeaways from your book that you brought forth from doing this?
Well, although we haven't concentrated on that much, there were significant links between Muslim radical thinkers who were anti-colonialist and also sometimes wanted reform in the Middle East to introduce aspects of the West to help fight off the West, as it were, to make them competitive. And it was between there were connections and links between Masonic lodges and Freemasonry and those Muslim radicals and others as well. And it seems that these links in themselves are historically very significant. And I mentioned Quilliam, who was the founder of the first mosque in Great Britain, the first official mosque anyway. And you know, it may have offered them some other more practical help as well, and that occasionally they could be introduced to the more broader sort of esoteric and spiritual underground, which was sympathetic to Islam in some cases. For example, in Australia, there was some sympathy among spiritualists for Islam, and Quilliam was able to connect there. But yeah, I think that we don't really give enough credence to how important links between Muslim radical political thinkers and Freemasonry has been, and also in shaping these different religions, such as Moorish science as well. But I think also, it's no coincidence that we have today, on the one hand, we have sort of New Agey philosophy, and even beyond that now, of course, I mean, that was more 60s, but we have, you know, yoga and meditation and these sort of ideas of spirituality that 100 years ago would have been associated with someone like Aleister Crowley, you know, or the Golden Dawn before that, perhaps. And so we have that, but we also have sort of very militant Islamism and these kind of movements. And it's not really, to me, surprising that you have them both at the same time when you can look back 100-150 years and you have connections between these sort of these at least in the prehistory of these groups that are in some way connected.
Yeah, it's very fascinating, and
yeah,
I'm hoping we can concentrate more on some of those connections between Islamism and Freemasonry and sort of the way that they try to turn a Western institution upon the West itself in some ways.
Yeah.
Well, could you please remind people of your book and where they could find it and where they can find you online?
Sure. Well, they can go to angelmillar.com, and Millar is M-I-L-L-A-R, or they can go to islam-freemasonry.com.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And the book is The Crescent and the Compass, available from Newman Books, and
yeah,
I'm sure it will be available at all your favorite online outlets.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to the book, and I'm very anxious to see how it's received. I'm sure it's going to be making quite an impact.
Well, great. I hope so.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Angel. It's wonderful to speak with you again, and I very much appreciate you taking time with us tonight.
Oh, great. Thanks. Thanks very much, Greg. It's always great speaking to you. It's a pleasure.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Angel Millar delves more deeply into the connections between Freemasonry and Islam. Topics include Sheikh Quilliam, Emanuel Swedenborg, Zionism and the Protocols. We also talk about Anders Breivik and the Norway massacre in relation to Breivik's alleged Templar connections. And finally, we discuss Charles, Prince of Wales, and his traditionalist and Islamic sympathies. Don't miss that fascinating conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
Thank you.